Victor Hugo said, "What causes night in our souls may have stars." The 9/11 attacks drove Terry Rauschenbach to enlist in the military, and it wouldn't be long before he was deployed to the front lines in Afghanistan. After surviving a near-fatal gunshot wound in a harrowing firefight, Terry would face the ultimate battle of his life while trying to recover both physically and mentally. At the dawn of the darkest night in his life, Terry would find a star and, against the advice of doctors, go on to complete one of the toughest sporting events invented, the Ironman. While the battle with his injury may never truly end, Terry will continue finding the stars in his life, such as with his clothing brand, Rhode Island Original.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of C4 Podcast, C4 Southeast Asian Athlete Achievement Through Adversity. And if you guys haven't already, please follow us on Facebook and Instagram, like, comment, share. That helps with the algorithms. If you know of someone you want to nominate, an athlete or an individual that's gone through adversity, please message us online. Our guest today, while let's say like not necessarily an athlete, I'd say, gosh, you know, in his situation, like I as an athlete, I win or lose, I lose. I might seem like the end of the world, but I'm going to come back the next day, right? In this gentleman's case, if he loses, it's the end of his life. And he shares on his YouTube video the experience that he went through, which almost cost him his life. So great guest today. For now, I'm going to turn it over to John Messina, my co-host, and he will introduce our guest.
Yeah. So before we jump into that, we wanted to give a quick shout out to our friends at the Now in Session podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, you see these cool shirts Co and I are wearing. Thank you to Lucky, Toby, and Charles for sending us these things.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. If you like our show, you'll love their show. They cover a lot of cool topics. Lucky is a veteran himself. And if you like this episode in particular, they have an episode with a special forces operations guy, Paul Chopra, which was just phenomenal. So check out their show on YouTube, follow them on Instagram. Really good show. If you like this one, you will love their show. So thanks, Lucky, Toby, and Charles for all the support. We started our podcast around the same time, so we're kind of on this journey together, and we appreciate everything they do. Now, with that, we've received several messages asking us to include more veterans, law enforcement type people on the show. We are doing that because, like Ko was saying, Ko was a professional athlete. It may seem like the end of the world if you lose, right? But the stakes are completely different in the military, right? The stakes, you know, it's your life's on the line. It's not a game. It's not a trophy. It's your life in a lot of cases, the lives of your teammates as well. So we appreciate all the veterans. We interviewed Tron Sipitsai, Navy SEAL, a while back. And I just wanted to talk about something because after that interview, we started getting a lot of messages saying that we really should have talked about John Dongdara. John was a military dog handler assigned to SEAL Team 6. In 2011, he and 29 other U.S. troops died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. That included 17 Navy SEALs, several Afghan commandos, and I think some support personnel like translators as well. Very deadly incident. John was lost in that. There's actually a dog park in John's hometown of South Sioux City named after him in his memory. John's dog was also lost in the crash. So we apologize for not mentioning him during the episode with Tron while we're talking about Navy SEALs. So, you know, our hearts go out to the Dongdara family, and we want to help keep his memory alive. And that's why we are talking about him today. But with that, we have another Afghanistan veteran on with us, Terry Rauschenbach, and he almost lost his life as well. So we're going to go ahead and he's going to bravely walk us through his story. He has his own podcast and talks to about his story and veterans on his own channel. He'll tell us about that in a bit. So with that, Terry, first introduce yourself, and then let's our listeners like us to start at the beginning, hearing how people have, you know, how their families came from Laos and so forth. So start from the beginning of your life, man, and your family's history in Laos.
Oh, hey guys, Terry Rauschenbach here. Recovering from a cold, so I apologize if you see me sucking on this throat a lot. Just don't want to be feeling sandpaper in the back of my throat the whole time. Born in Maryland, Silver Spring, Maryland, raised in Rhode Island, And my parents are immigrants that came here from escaping the war, Vietnam. And honestly, I don't really know my parents too well. I don't know. I feel like this is fairly common amongst Asian households. Like, your parents aren't your friends. You know, they love you, they raise you, but I really don't know much about them. I've asked them a few questions, but all I know is that they escaped the war and they decided to move to Rhode Island.
Okay. So what was your upbringing like, your childhood? Were you into sports? What did you kind of do through high school and so forth?
So I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island. It's more of a urban environment. And I grew up as a church kid as well. So I was a pretty good kid, stayed out of trouble. But growing up in an urban environment, it's pretty easy to get in trouble. I mean, I went to the kind of school where it's like you had gangs and you had, like, you know, street violence and that typical sort of thing. So I love the fact of where I was born. Just like in hindsight, knowing my parents could have like moved anywhere, they could have moved to Tennessee and I would have had some sort of like accent or drawl. You know what I mean? Nothing is wrong with that. But I've met a Laotian guy who's from Tennessee, and when he said hello, it was like Sabade, you know. And so yeah, I just, like, when I went to boot camp, I remember just talking to some of the other recruits there, because we get guys from all around the country. Like, one kid was 17, and he's like, he's never met a black man in his life. And so I'm at boot camp, I'm meeting all these kids, and they're like, stop trying to act black, this and that. I'm like, I'm just trying to be me, you know. Just so I appreciate growing up where I grew up. Around 8th grade, my parents saved enough money, they moved us into the suburbs, and I had this real street mentality of like, am I allowed to swear? I'll try not to swear.
No, you can swear.
But yeah, so like, I'm a kid, I'm just an idiot. I'm like, oh, fuck this. I'm not gonna make any friends here. Like, I can't relate to these kids, you know, these rich yuppies. And it's like middle class suburbs, you know what I mean? But again, I come from a place where it's like open street violence. Like, there was like crack needles on the sidewalk. It wasn't like super violent, but it was like just an urban environment. And so yeah, that was my upbringing, from like from 8th grade about there, urban environment, moved to the suburbs, and joined the military, and my world exploded, where it's like, oh, like, the world's so much bigger than just kind of like the hood and then the suburbs and then just Rhode Island in general. It's, you obviously, as you become an adult, you learn really quickly, it doesn't matter, but like, really, where you're from, we're all just people, we're all just trying to find things in life that makes us happy and just prosper.
Yeah, tell us a little more in detail of what made you pursue the military. What was your reasoning behind that?
I joined primarily because of 9/11. I was, I think, a junior in high school at the time, and I was so young. Like, when it happened, I was like, it didn't really click on me. I'm not one to follow politics, and so to me, it was just like, oh shit, like, something happened. Okay. But, you know, it's constantly in the news. As I'm understanding it, I'm understanding we're under attack. Our country was under attack. And I just, like anyone else, that just galvanized me to want to do something. I grew up not, like, I grew up, like, aware of the Army, you know, G.I. Joes and all that. But, like, I never had a propensity to join and enlist. But when the war kicked off, I knew I just wanted to essentially become a Marine and join the infantry and make my way there. But that didn't happen. I ended up joining the National Guard, which is a long story, unless you guys want to hear that.
Yeah, make it shorter, but we'd love to hear
okay.
it.
Okay. All right. So basically, senior year, I didn't apply for any colleges. I think I took my SATs. I can't remember. But, like, you know, every kid's got the applications put in. They've got accepted here, they got accepted there. It's literally a month left until I graduate high school. And I'm like, I'm just going to join the Marines. I'm just going to be the infantry. And then somebody tells me that you can't enlist if you have asthma. I didn't know that. And I've had bad asthma since I was a kid. And later I find out this person, like, he just probably tells everyone the same war story. Like, oh, I went to boot camp. And then, like, they asked me if you have asthma. And I raised my hand, they kicked me out, which is true. But during the war, nobody cared. You just had to keep your mouth shut. And even if you did say you had asthma, they gave you an inhaler, which is with the case for me. Yeah. So instead of becoming a Marine, I joined the National Guard. I didn't know anything about the National Guard. Someone was like, oh, they'll give you a gun. I was like, yeah. They was like, yeah, just don't mention your asthma. You can't do that now, but at the time, that's what I did. I just kept my mouth shut. I enlisted and made my way to the infantry.
Okay. So tell us, leading up to that day in Afghanistan where you were shot and hurt, just tell us about your career, kind of your service, what you did, where you deployed, all that kind of stuff prior to that incident.
Okay. Yeah. So when I enlisted into the Army National Guard, I told my recruiter I want to be an infantryman. He's like, no, you're smarter than that. He's like, you don't want to do that. I was like, yeah, I think I do. And he was like, you know what? So because I didn't go to college, I knew I had to do something. So I signed up for a trade school, and they don't care if you got a good grades. They just want your money. So I signed up for the program. I did 18 months, and I got my certificate to be to work on automobiles, just be a mechanic. And the recruiter was like, listen, you have a degree in automotive repair. You're not dumb. At least sign up to be a mechanic. That way, if it doesn't work out, you'll have a strong resume and a job you can fall back on. So I was like, well, that fucking sounds great. So I did that. No, and he said, like, after I came back and was qualified as a mechanic, then I become an infantryman. And it made sense to me at the time. But in 2004, everyone wanted to be a killer. Everyone wanted to go to war. And so there weren't enough slots for me to join the infantry. I had to wait a year or so, still like trying to find a unit, make my way into a unit, just get into the fight. And I tried to go active duty, but the active duty recruiter told me that there wasn't any room as 11 Bravos, your standard infantryman. There was just room for more men. It was, again, I didn't know any better. He was just playing these fuck games. And then there was a unit in the Rhode Island National Guard that said, hey, we're expanding from a detachment. It was a letters company, long range surveillance, into a bigger actual unit, an airborne infantry company. We'll take you in. So I joined them. I reclassed, became an infantryman, and caught word of a unit in Connecticut deploying, and immediately, after getting people's blessings, joined their unit, and then went to war with a bunch of people that I didn't know at all. And about 3 months later, was deployed.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I was wondering how, because I saw you were in the Connecticut National Guard. I was trying to figure out how that came about. So you get deployed to Afghanistan, and then so folks, Terry's got his own channel, and what we're going to do is he was injured in combat, Purple Heart recipient. We're not going to make him recount the whole thing on the show, so we're actually going to go over and watch a quick clip from his channel where he's going to take us through that day. Okay.
Hey guys, my name is Terry. I am co-founder and co-owner of Rhode Island Original, and I am also a U.S. Army National Guard veteran. And I'm also a recipient of the Purple Heart, and this is my story on how I received my Purple Heart. Basically, in 2009, I deployed with the Connecticut Army National Guard to Afghanistan. I was with the infantry, and as an infantryman, our job was to find and engage the Taliban. About 6 months into our deployment, we've already received a lot of heavy contact. We, as a company, we survived ambushes, mortar attacks, small arms fire, IEDs, and suicide bombers. So by 6 months, we were just pretty busy. Around that time, it was my turn to take leave for R&R. Basically, soldiers are allowed 2 weeks leave from their deployment. Just 2 weeks to get away from the war, go back home, visit their family, friends, and loved ones, and all that. And I decided I wanted to go to Peru. I wanted to go visit Machu Picchu. And I came across a nonprofit called Globeteers, where people were able to volunteer at an orphanage and teach underprivileged kids English and essentially be a big brother. And I thought that was a great idea. That's where I wanted to go, and that's where I booked my tickets for leave. So it was the day following my 24th birthday. I just turned 24. My birthday is July 2nd, and it was also my last mission before I leave. And I'm generally a really optimistic person. I like to focus on the positive things, except on this day, it felt like Murphy's Law. I felt like everything was too good to be true. And I just had this really bad feeling that something bad was gonna happen. I just couldn't shake it. I just had all this anxiety building up inside of me. And I literally said out loud, "Yep, I'm gonna die." So we went on a mission to do a KLE, which is a key leader engagement. Essentially, our leader talks to their leader. And as we went to a village to conduct the KLE, we heard some small arms fire. Basically, it was our Afghan counterparts shooting at what they believed would be the Taliban setting up for an attack. And it was a really short engagement. And after that, I was like, yeah, that was it. You know, all that anxiety I had built up was for nothing. And so I was really pumped that day. I was really excited that it was a short mission. I was excited that all that anxiety was over nothing. I mean, after, you know, some heavy contact, the smallest fire really was nothing to us. So as we were patrolling back to the base, in the truest sense of the unexpected, as if you were driving on the highway and all the windows in the car shattered, we were caught in an unexpected ambush. My squad was in the kill zone, and I know that because one of my teammates had told us months after the ambush that he saw an arm swing out over a cliff holding an AK and essentially spraying and praying. And after that person started shooting at us, we started receiving machine gun fire from all around us in the valley. And so everybody started running for cover. I jumped off the road. We were on a road patrolling back to the base alongside of a mountain. I landed in a ditch, and as I looked around, I tried to identify where the shooting was coming from. I couldn't see the shooter, so I told my buddy to cover me while I bounded up the mountain in order to get a recon by fire. I was a light machine gunner, and my job is to suppress heavy fire. That way, my guys can maneuver and try to gain some superiority over the enemy. I remember I wasn't trying to be Rambo. I wasn't trying to be a hero. I was just trying to do my job, and I was trying to maneuver towards the fire and try to pinpoint where the enemy was so I could lay down some rounds. I remember as soon as I got up to the mountain, I realized I was way further from my guys than I should have been. The moment I realized how far I was, I knew I needed to turn back. They started shooting at me, and I ducked for cover immediately at the nearest rock I could find. It was a really small rock. It was just big enough for me to cover my body as long as I tucked my head between my knees. So I stayed there, and as I listened to the gunfire, I couldn't hear the rounds above me. Normally, when you're getting shot at and they're getting really accurate, you can hear the rounds whizzing past your head. And if you're around concrete or a bunch of rocks, the bullets will land on the rocks near you, and it'll sound like crackling of like open electric wires. But I couldn't hear the rounds whizzing, and I knew that they weren't really shooting close to me. They couldn't find me. So I popped up and I got on my right knee and I started shooting at them. They stopped shooting, and then they quickly responded to their own burst of rounds. I tucked my head back down and I shot another burst myself. So I felt like the Wild West. It felt like, you know, just two people shooting at each other back and forth. And suddenly I was hit with the most excruciating pain in my entire life. It felt like someone took one of those fireplace pokers and just skewered my leg from my left cheek all the way into my thigh. And immediately after skewering me with that poker, it felt like someone reached into my thigh and was shredding my muscles with their bare hand. The pain was so intense. I didn't scream. I didn't shout. I just I tried my best to deal with the pain. It just took over my mind. We've all stubbed our toe, and you know, you stubbed your toe, and that pain shoots up your foot. You just freeze in place. You kind of like hold in your breath, and you just wait for the pain to subside. That's how I felt with my body. My entire body was flexing and flinching, just trying to survive the pain. I remember just laying on the ground, my lower back arched, clawing and gripping the earth. And eventually my body just gave out, it collapsed. It was, it gave out on its own, kind of like when you do push-ups until failure. And eventually my mind came to, and my eyes started focusing on whatever I was looking at, and I could see the trail that had led me up the mountain, and I realized that I was shot. And I knew I needed to get back down that mountain and get closer to my guys, but there was just no way I was gonna be able to low crawl down this mountain. So I shouted for my teammate who last saw me. I shouted his name, and my voice was drowned out by all the shooting going on. So I waited for maybe about 30 seconds. I tried to wait for a lull, but still, we're in this valley and there's machine guns going off from every direction. My guy shooting, the enemy shooting. But I tried shouting for my teammate again, and no response. He can't hear me. So I lay there, and at this point, I'm wondering how far the enemy is who shot me. I'm wondering if he's gonna run up and finish me off. I play these scenarios in my mind of someone just coming up and ripping into my skin with 7.62 rounds. And I just wait there not knowing what to do. So I was raised in the church and I began to pray. My parents are Christians before I was even born. So I laid there praying to God, and I wasn't trying to trick myself into believe something like an angel to come out of the sky or some sort of mystery soldier to come out of nowhere and just carry me away to safety. But I was just casting out my faith and hope in God that he was gonna do something to send me a sign that I was gonna be okay. But nothing changed. The shooting continued. There wasn't a sound of helicopters in the air. I didn't hear anybody shout for my name. And I slowly started realizing that I was gonna die. So I made myself as comfortable as possible laying there on the ground. I just kept staring at the sky, and I waited for either a miracle or for death. And as I lay there waiting, I kept looking at the sky. It was so blue, and it was so beautiful, and it looked like it was picture perfect, as if it could be one of those photos on a desktop computer. It just seemed way too happy. It just seemed so happy while I was laying there dying, and I got really pissed off. I just went absolutely postal. I think I was pissed at God. I was pissed at myself for accepting the fact that I thought I was gonna die. And I literally screamed out loud, "Fuck dying in Afghanistan. I am not fucking dying here." So without even thinking of it, I grabbed a machine gun, I put it on safe, I dug the barrel into the earth, and I pushed myself over the cliff. And I landed in a matter of seconds. I landed on a switchback beneath me, maybe 5 or 6 feet. And without even thinking, I did it again. I grabbed my machine gun and I shoved myself over the side of a mountain. This time, I'm airborne and the fall is like 80 feet. And I just do this belly flop and I slam on the ground, splat into this puddle of water. And immediately, I clutched my right hand to make sure I'm still holding on to my machine gun, and I could feel my rucksack with all my ammo resting perfectly in my lower back, and it's just there's no encouragement to move. But the water, it's cooling my burning thigh, and I just I just wanted to lay there. I just wanted to fall asleep. But the moment I thought of sleeping, the idea terrified me because I knew if I fell asleep, I might not ever wake up again. So I lifted my left hand and I started waving in the air like SOS flag. But I was so tired and I kept my face in the mud. I kept my face in the dirt and I just kept waving my arm, hoping for someone to see me. Maybe 5-10 minutes went by and finally someone spotted me. And a group of my guys ran up to me and they started working on freeing me from my equipment. Someone grabbed my machine gun, somebody grabbed my ruck. And by then, I'm feeling drunk, you know? I know my guys are there and they're helping me out, but I just remember just feeling like hands working on my body. And then my body's tumbling and somehow I'm rolling down this little small hill and I land in a stream of water. And it's funny, but somehow I remember and I realized that no one's doing anything, you know? One moment everyone's working on, you know, trying to save me, and then next moment everyone's just staring at me as my body just laying there lifeless in the water. I think everyone was kind of a bit in shock because I've always been such a PT stud. I've always been the fastest, if not one of the fastest guys in the company. I've always maxed out my push-ups and sit-ups. So I guess to see me laying there lifeless was a real shocker. But somebody snapped out of it, and before I knew it, someone was grabbing me by my collar, and just dragging me across the earth towards the gun truck. That person was my squad leader, and whatever pain I was feeling in my leg, all that pain started focusing on my chest and my neck as gravel and rocks and dirt was scraping my chest and my face. As painful as that was, I was actually really happy because I remember thinking, like, I am now literally in the hands of my teammates and my guys. I know they're not going to let me die. So my squad leader managed to drag me to the gun truck, and now there's still combatants in the area, and he needs me on my feet, and he can't lift me on his own. So somehow I find the strength to stand up on both feet, even though I'm shot in my leg, even though I didn't know I wasn't certain I was shot, but I was shot in my leg, and I don't know how I didn't black out, but I stood up on my leg, and I crawled into the gun truck. They rush me on base and they get me inside our medical tent. And in there, things really started, my memory really started going in and out. I remember my body felt really cold. I wasn't shivering, but I was cold. And my mind started going in and out like a really bad radio signal. They couldn't find an exit wound, but my leg was swollen. So they knew there was damage going on in there. And they found a small entry wound in my left cheek, so they assumed it was just shrapnel. And then within 5 to 10 minutes, we had a bird arrive on the cop, and I remember them getting me on a stretcher. They had one of those insulator things wrapped around me, trying to keep me warm. And as they were carrying me to the bird, everybody was telling me, "Terry, you gotta stay awake, you gotta stay awake." And I could understand why I needed to stay awake, but I was just so tired and I was so cold. And the moment that the sunlight hit my skin, it really felt euphoric. It felt like a drug. It felt so nice to be warm. You know that feeling when you're watching a movie and it's really late at night and you really want to watch the film, but you're really sleepy, you're feeling drowsy, and you drift off to sleep? Well, that's how it felt for me. I knew I could have held on, but the sun felt so nice and I was just so fucking tired. I remember just deciding to release my grip in reality. And I didn't wake up until later in a forward hospital in country. I remember seeing the battalion commander there, and I remember trying to give him a situation report, and then looking over and seeing three nurses in full scrubs. They had the saddest look in their eyes for me. I remember staring at their faces, looking for an explanation, and they couldn't look at me. They looked away, and I put my head down. And when I woke up, I was in Germany. I didn't wake up until 2 days later. I remember waking up, and it wasn't like one of those groggy Sunday mornings when, you know, you're rubbing your eyes and you're kind of stretching. It was instantaneous. My eyes snapped open. I wasn't freaked out. I knew I was in the hospital. I knew I was injured. But what did freak me out was I realized I had a tube jammed down my throat, and I grabbed it reactively, and I started pulling on it. I started tugging, and dark purple bitter goo started oozing out of my mouth. And when I started gurgling, there was a nurse in the room who rushed over, who heard my gurgles, and she calmed me down. She let me know it was a feeding tube, which made sense, and calmed me down. The doctors came in and informed me multiple times that I was a very lucky young man. He said that had I arrived any more than 2 minutes, I would have bled out to death. In fact, I needed blood so quickly that they gave me untreated blood and had to test my blood for an entire year to make sure I didn't have those any STDs or HIV or anything like that, which there isn't. I don't have. And he also told me that the round had hit me at one of the only angles where I was able to keep my hip. Any other angle, he said it would have been game over. I was transported to Walter Reed Army Medical Center. I spent 10 months there rehabilitating and undergoing 12 surgeries. Currently, I can't run and I'll never run again. Essentially what happened was the round had entered my left cheek and into my thigh and hit my bone. When it hit my bone, it exploded and it essentially became a mini grenade. Shrapnel came this way and shrapnel came this way. A piece of shrapnel took out a chunk of the ball of my head and my femur. So if this is my femur and this is the head, which is inside my hip, it's missing a chunk. So if I were to run, it would just demolish my hip, the ball of my hip, and turn into chalk dust. So I can't ever run again. And eventually I will need a new hip. It's not a matter of if, but a matter of when. But I'm just happy to be alive. Like I said, I like to focus on the positive. It took a while for me to find the positive. Walter Reed was probably was the worst experience of my life. I mean, I'm so thankful for the doctors, the nurses, what they did. But it was really hard, not just physically, but emotionally. I mean, I wanted to make the infantry a career and take away my ability to run, took away my chances with doing that, making the infantry a career. But I'm happy to be alive, obviously, and coming so close to death just gave me such massive perspective. I mean, there's been days where I've been sad, and instantly I could just transport myself back to that exact location, Afghanistan, back to that place and time where I was lying there just waiting to die, and life isn't that bad. I mean, I really shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be here making this video. I shouldn't be doing the things that I do. I should be 6 feet under right now. I know that. And I'm just grateful to be alive. Eventually, I did make it to Peru, and I did get to volunteer with Global Tears. I got to travel the world some more. I even did Ironman. Not running. I did the run with crutches. And I'm actually training for another Ironman, a double Ironman. But I guess that's another story.
Yeah, wow, man. Great video. I mean, very, very heartfelt. tell us about the recovery process. How was it for you physically? How was it for you mentally? Yeah, tell us about your rehab.
Oh, man. So, Walter Reed, 10 months. It was absolutely the worst experience of my life. And that's not throwing shade at Walter Reed or anything like that. The nurses and the doctors did a fantastic job. And it's just tough. It's just tough all around being injured and being someplace for 10 months where your life is constantly, you know, you're just in a flux. I don't know else how to put it. It's your biggest issue is it should be your injury, but there's so many little things that happens along the way that just adds a frustration because you're still in the Army. So like when you got these 07 formations, you know, and you're just fucked up, you're in this wheelchair, and then like now you're following a bunch of other broke dicks to go to the formation. And it's just so many people are just broken and hurt, and they're just kind of fed up, you know. And that's not everybody, because Walter Reed, there's lots of, you know, you get injured, you go there for whatever kind of reason. But, and this is probably just also me having negative at the moment, I guess, or pockets of negativity. But after a while, just being on there just like starts to like get at you. I'm naturally a pretty positive person. I always try to find that silver lining. But again, like, there's just so many little things that happen that just built up my time at Walter Reed that just, like, makes you want to put a head, get my head through the wall when I think about it. I mean, like, probably my second or third day at Walter Reed, one of the nurses pulls a command sergeant major into my room. He's like, you got to hear this guy's story. And I tell my story. And at the end of it, the command sergeant major is like, and then you roll down the mountain. And I was like, you just heard my story. But no, I was like, Sergeant Major, like I threw myself off a mountain. And he's like, then you rolled down the mountain. I'm an E4, so I'm trying to be respectful as possible, even though I'm laid in this hospital bed all fucked up. And he's like, then you rolled down the mountain. And then I started picking up what he wanted me to do. He wanted me to reaffirm that I didn't actually throw myself off the mountain. I rolled down the mountain. He was essentially calling bullshit on my story. So, but that didn't really get to me, whatever. I'm in good spirits. And again, you know, Walter Reed's still early. Just little things that just pile up, like the 04, the doctors are doing their rounds, and like I'm sleeping in bed, and the motherfucker doesn't even wake me up. He just grabs my pen, he grabs like my bandage, rips it off so he can inspect it. That's how he wakes me up. And like my fist is in the air, like I'm just reacting. He's like, don't hit me. And just things like that just all start accumulating over the span of 10 months, aside from my leg. And like, you know, that's just being annoyed. Like that's just like kind of like bad customer experience. But like at Walter Reed, I'm just sitting there like dealing with the fact that like I am no longer ever going to be an infantryman. That's probably one of the most painful things as well, where I was in the National Guard, but I knew I wanted to make a career. I knew at some point I was going to do active duty. Actually, I was planning to go and join the Marines, be all poetic and full circle, go back and enlist full active duty Marines. But I think a lot of people spend a lot of time in their life trying to figure out what their passion is, what makes them happy, what gives them as much energy as it takes from you. And for me, and I'm not trying to make myself sound like some sort of high speed SF Delta or Ranger guy at all. I wasn't at all. I was just your average infantryman, just a Joe. But I was that guy where if it was a Saturday, I'd be blindfolding myself with my kit on, doing magazine changes blindfolded. I was that guy that was just always killing in PT. So in the back of my mind, like I knew like if I ever had to run and like save my buddy's life or like pick up a body and put it on my shoulder, I'd be in the best shape of my life. Like nobody had to motivate me to do any of that. I was just constantly reading, constantly learning. And like, I knew like within the infantry community, I would eventually, yeah, get tired of pulling triggers and deploying, but within this community, find where I would spend the rest of my life because there's so many avenues. And the moment I got injured and the doctor told me I would never run again, I just knew all that was off the board. Like, you can't be an infantryman if you can't run. So emotionally sitting there dealing with that, knowing like it's like losing the love of your life, if that makes any sense. Like if anyone's ever been dumped, and it's like I love you, like I didn't want this to end, like you chose this to end, and like now like I can't have this in my life. It that's how I felt. I felt like I lost a love in my life, and now it's like, what do I do? Well, I gotta find a new love, but it's like, you know, I don't. That was perfect for me. I don't know what else to do. Like I'm gonna move forward. So that was emotionally sad. The fact that like, I mean, you would imagine like if somebody gets shot in the leg, it would have been fine, but the fact that the bullet exploded in my leg. So my hypothesis is the guys we were shooting were firing at us with PKMs, anti-aircraft machine guns, and AKs. And we were surrounded all around a valley. So I can only imagine the rounds hit the dirt, maybe or rock and ricocheted. It went to my leg because an AK round or a PKM round should have like, just ripped through my leg. So the fact that a round hit my bone exploded, I just the surge is just accumulating, and it's like I just kept thinking I was out of there, but like conditions kept getting worse and worse. I mean, one surgery went bad where it's like I thought I was sick because obviously you're not supposed to be drinking while you're taking pills and all that. Again, young kid, dumb, and I was just taking my pain meds and drinking, you know, just being sad and just drinking in my room, and I thought maybe I was hungover the next day. And I just couldn't see it in my eye. I was just like, just feeling like shit. And it got progressively worse till like I lost sight in my left eye. I went to the ER room and they did a swab test. I'm just bullshitting with the nurse, thinking like it's not a big thing. And then like 15 minutes later, some doctor walks in. She's like, we gotta give you like Spinal Tap ASAP. I'm like, whoa, like. Long story short, there, one of the surgeries, something went wrong, and then it accumulated a virus in my body, and the virus kept spreading. So that was now it's in my blood system, it's circulating all throughout my body, and that's just an example of like where things just constantly went south, where I ended up having 12 surgeries instead of just like you would just imagine one or two surgeries for a bullet wound. So I'm dealing with things at Walter Reed where it's like it's not because it's Walter Reed. This is just like any hospital setting where it's like the doctors. Some doctors have horrible bedside manners. It's like fucking, it's like midnight. I finally fell asleep and I can never sleep. I'm constantly in pain. And the janitor comes in and like he slams close the trash can really loud. And now I'm like fucking pissed because I can't sleep. I got a roommate next to me who's like next door, was just being a complete fucking asshole who's like just screaming at a nurse and I can't sleep there. Emotionally, I'm just fucked up where it's like, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And for 10 months, that was my experience. And there was definitely pockets of like joy. Trust me, it wasn't all doom and gloom. And I know my brain's just, that's the first thing that comes to my mind, all those interactions. But when you say Walter Reed and you're asking me like, you know, how I was, it's just a whole lot of hurt and a whole lot of ways that come to my mind. And definitely the worst experience.
Oh, so even when you got out of there, you know, mentally, how did you get yourself back in the right frame of mind after?
So for a while I clung on to religion. I think, you know, I was raised in the church since I was born. My parents, when they came here, they met a minister, and so they've been going to church since I was born. I come from like a background of Christianity where it's like you see in the movies, like they pray out the devil, they sing and clap, and you know, it's like a Southern kind of church. I had that kind of faith where it's like, if I just pray, God will save me. But I remember the day I was shot, like I just knew God wasn't gonna save me. And that's how I, you know, I had the anger to throw myself off the mountain. And I would pray from time to time. But eventually I just lost all faith in God. So like faith in God probably got me through that a little bit. And then after that, it was just drinking like a lot of people do. And honestly, I'm probably not giving myself enough credit because I am super optimistic. And again, I think I'm just focusing right now on the tough times where it got bad. But I was very optimistic, and I just knew, like, I wasn't gonna let keep me down. In fact, I was so optimistic out of the entire company of Wounded Warriors, they gave me a roommate who was suicidal because they thought my positivity would rub off on him. And by the end of it, like, I told our first sergeant, "You gotta get this guy fucking out of here." It was so bad, like I wanted to fight the guy. So, like, again, another example of how, like, I was just losing my shit at Walter Reed.
Yeah, wow, that's intense. Well, so somehow I know you haven't 100% recovered. You'll never be back to where you were, you know, when you walked into the military, but you found a way to participate in Ironmans, which, you know, never had an injury. I'm not even going to do an Ironman. And I know you had to maybe compromise a little bit, but tell us how you got into that and just tell us about how you did it.
So when I was at at Walter Reed, you know, some of the doctors, like, oh, or my physical therapist aide was like, "Oh, what do you want to do when you get out of here?" And I was like, "Oh, I definitely want to do like an Ironman, like, definitely want to do it." And later he told me that a few of the doctors rolled their eyes, and that pissed me off. That let a spark underneath my ass. I was like, fuck those guys. And I still at the time, I didn't know any better, like, why they were telling me I couldn't run. I can physically run. Like, now it's even worse because it's like 10 plus years later. But like, obviously I shouldn't run. And so I just didn't understand exactly how the extent of my injuries. And I was like, no, fuck them. I'm going to run. And I decided to start looking for an Ironman eventually when I got better enough. It took like 5-6 months to reach my toes. So by the time I got to that place where I felt like I could start training, it was all pure, like, anger. It was all hate. It was like straight David Goggins. It was like, fuck you, constant fuck you, constant fuck you, I'm going to do it. And, yeah, I got through a 70.3 Ironman, like a half Ironman, not fully expecting, not knowing if I was going to be able to do it all. I just wanted to do it. And I did the half Ironman. And I was like, oh, shit, well, maybe I could do a full. And so then I signed up to do a full. The full was, it was attached to a nonprofit, so that motivated me as well. But if I had to be honest, because as I did the full Ironman, I had a news team like following me, and they were asking me questions. They're like, "How does it feel? What were you thinking of when you were training?" And under the gun of the camera and the lights, I felt like I had to say like the PC thing. So I was like, "Oh yeah, you know, when I'm in the water, like when I'm underwater swimming, I'm swimming for like an hour plus nonstop." I was like, yeah, I think of the kid I'm training for, and which sometimes I would use him as a motivation tool. But if I had to be completely honest, it was just all fucking hate, anger, and caffeine driving me.
Wow. And for those that don't know, so an Ironman is a run, swim, bike, right? What's like, isn't it like a marathon? I don't know. What is an Ironman?
Ironman is a swim, bike, run, and I always forget the length, but
okay. It's long. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it's long.
Well, cool.
Hey, Terry, tell us about Rhode Island Original. I mean, what's that all about?
So Rhode Island Original is a clothing brand I started. Just Rhode Island theme, Rhode Island Pride t-shirts and hoodies. Basically, a good friend of mine was trying to start a clothing brand, and I didn't know anything about business. I didn't know at the time, like, everyone and their mother was trying to create their own clothing brand. But he's telling me why it wasn't working. And as angry and negative as I sound earlier, I went on that rant. I am a pretty positive person. I generally will always find a silver lining, and just silver lining, got it. You know, that's my marker to move forward. And I kept pushing him on all these ideas. I'm like, oh, you should just try this. You should try this. And then we came to the conclusion. Like, I was like, you know what? I'll help you out, because he doesn't really have a structured mindset or like the get after spirit. And originally, like, what we wanted to do was they create like a fitness brand, like, and like, it's so, I don't know if it's dumb and cliche here at this point, but like, in hindsight, after the Rhode Island Original was created, just because I was like, oh, you know what, when I was deploying, I was trying to find a cool Rhode Island t-shirt. I couldn't find anything. All I found was like, you know, some stuff on Amazon or like something very generic and bland, nothing really cool. So I was like, you know what, let's start a Rhode Island clothing business. just as the to get our feet wet, you know, and just because I really want a cool Rhode Island t-shirt. And I can't do anything really half-assed, and I just went full bore. And in hindsight, I see now what I was trying to do is I was just trying to find a new mission in life. I was just trying to find something to get that spark going in me again. And someone who was never interested in business and always thought business was for people, you know, who were like snakes in the grass and just smoke and mirrors. I started falling in love with the idea of everything that comes with it, the creativity, the marketing, the new talents you have to pick up, you know, podcasting, videography, photography, then the whole networking stuff. I really started getting into it, and I let it consume me where it's like I stopped letting myself feel sorry for myself and or just being angry or sitting there because after Walter Reed, for 9 years straight, at some point I realized I drank every night. It was, even though it wasn't like every night, I was getting hammered or slushed. I had to drink at least 1 to 3 hard rum and cokes every night because I was just like, what the fuck am I gonna do with the rest of my life? Like, I'm young and I'm sad and like, I don't know. I don't want to go fucking like, I don't know. I don't want to, I don't know. There's just nothing else appealed to me at the time. And so this t-shirt thing really grabbed my interest, and that's what really propelled me to keep doing it.
Cool. Well, we want to give a shout out to our other friends from Rhode Island, Andres and Jamie Sukumthat.
Oh yeah.
We consider them the Rhode Island originals. I don't know if you grew up with Andre or anything like that, but
didn't grow up with Andre. We knew because Rhode Island's pretty small, Asian community's pretty small. I knew him passing. We partied a few times.
Yeah.
A number of years before, you know, like he made it big and all that. But yeah, now they're pretty good friends. I was actually his officiant at his wedding.
Oh, awesome. That's cool. Yeah. Well, cool. Well, so you took the Rhode Island Original. You also, you know, launched your own podcast, both kind of the one that's with Rhode Island Original and then your own where you interview other veterans and stuff. I mean, what inspired you to get into podcasting and telling these military stories in particular?
So I got into podcasting more of an itch I had to scratch. And I don't consider myself having a podcast channel. I think technically I do, but I don't ever try to promote it. I don't ever, like, I'm not actively trying to find guests. It's literally, so for Rhode Island Original, I was trying to think of ways to create content, right? Just for the business itself. And I was experimenting with podcasting. And during the experimenting, I made a test video and I was just like shooting the shit with my friends. And I was bitching about something about military related or like my hip or something. And it just felt good to get it off my chest. And one day, I was talking to another vet. We both work full-time for the National Guard. We were just bitching about something. I'm like, listen, man, I need to do a podcast episode because, like, I'm losing my shit here. And I know, like, you probably feel the same way. There's other guys who feel the same way. And so he said yes, and we went from there. And I have a number of military friends. We just never really talk about the war with each other or things like that. And my first guest, my buddy Chanda, active duty Marine. And like, we see each other from time to time at cookouts. And we don't, just because we're vets, that's not our go-to topic. We talk about other things. And like, I learned that, you know, his first deployment, like they killed the dude. I think within like definitely the first week, it might have been like the first few days, he killed the guy young, right out of high school, joined the Marine Corps. And, you know, he witnessed the death of some of his friends. And it just felt good getting things off our chest and just to be able to bitch. And so when I see the opportunity, I'm talking to another vet. I'm like, hey, listen, is this something you want to talk about? And even now, currently deployed, I was talking to another vet and I bought some equipment to podcast. And I want to talk to a chaplain and ask him why I should believe in God again. And so I'm just following my curiosity. That's all it is.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I know it's not a formal podcast. It's just on your personal channel, but for those of you who, you know, who are enjoying this interview, the one with Chanda is pretty intense. Like Terry said, you're talking about an 18-year-old kid, right? Comes out of a high school, and then you're in a battlefield a few months later, fighting for your life and things like that. Very intense episode. So, wow. Well, cool.
Well, so, I mean, definitely, thank you so much for coming on. Very I mean, respect your honesty about everything too, man. That's it sounds like it was some tough times there. What does the future hold for you? You know, moving forward.
I wish I knew. I have no idea. I mean, I don't have any. I don't have any like any ties or responsibilities keeping me down. I'm not in a rush to get in a relationship. I should be, I guess, at my age. I'm 37. I'm still trying to figure it out, but and I actually plan on getting a tattoo on my back pretty soon. It's a Victor Hugo quote, "What makes darkness within you may leave stars." And I'm just happy I'm past that point in my life where the hurt and the heartache is gone. And I'm still in that phase of trying to figure out what it is I want to do for the rest of my life. I definitely want to continue Rhode Island Original. Now that I've done it long enough, I know I don't have the passion to make it a successful clothing brand, and I don't want to. So people get into business, obviously, because you want to make money. Products, especially t-shirts that don't have the greatest margins, if you don't have the capability to manufacture and print yourself, the margins aren't the best. But I'm going to keep doing that because I'm going to gear that towards a nonprofit. I'm going to keep doing it on Original. But as far as like full-time work, I'm not sure. And I'm just happy in a place that I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that's great. Well, good. Well, man, we really appreciate you. This. It couldn't have been easy to tell us this. I know it wasn't probably easy to talk about what you do on your own, you know, podcast. So we certainly appreciate you coming on. Folks, check out Terry's channel. Some fairly intense interviews on there. Check out Rhode Island Original as well. And with that, Co, any parting words?
No, thank you so much for, you know, coming on and sharing your story, man. This is what our podcast is about. And I tell you, from my own personal experience, this podcast, I started this with John because I wanted to let things out. I wanted to heal. You know, I suffered through my own adversity, whether it be drugs and alcohol and depression and all that. So to me, doing this, man, it ain't about the money. It's really about, you know, having other people come on and share what we have in common. So thank you so much, man, for being honest and being open.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks, Terry. The C4 Podcast is brought to you by the Lao American Sports Hall of Fame. Visit us on the web at laoamericansports.com, celebrating the first, inspiring the next.